The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS, 91.7 FM, Storrs, and WHUS.org, UConn's Radio for the People. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, our fourth annual Reasonably Catholic Keeping the Faith Year in Review, featuring snippets from as many as I could cram into the show of our 24 episodes that aired in 2015. I had a great time strolling down memory lane revisiting the shows, thanks to all of the terrific guests who risked endangering their immortal souls by coming on, and thanks, of course, to you listeners for tuning in. Speaking of whom, as of this writing, the station's fall-winter pledge drive is still shy by just a few hundred dollars of its goal. I'm just saying, did you do your part? Come on, start the new year right by showing WESU some love. My offer of a free Catholic-themed book for a donation of any size still stands. Find the list at reasonablycatholic.com. Okay, back in a moment with the first of our clips, an interview with Lincoln scholar Harold Holzer on the passing of his friend and writing partner, Governor Mario Cuomo.
Sure, humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit the shelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Up next, Harold Holzer reflects on one of the qualities that made his friend, the late Governor Cuomo, great. And then Commonweal critic Richard Oliva reviews the epic film Exodus. And finally, Brandon Nappy talks about why the Copper Beach Institute is important in an increasingly secular age.
This is a story about Mario Cuomo's perfect integrity. He's the most honest man I ever met in my life.
Oh, you're going to make me cry.
I know. So we're ready to do the book. He said, how are you going to do this? When are you, you know, he's very impatient. You know,
yes.
He worked all the time. He wanted us to work all the time. He used to call me at 6:30 in the morning and say, aren't you awake? Things like that. Anyway, I said, Gov, I'm trying to think of how to do it. He said, well, I'll give you two choices. He said, if you do it on weekends, then when we sign the contract, you can get half of the royalty. I'm not going to accept the royalty, but you can get half of it and enjoy it. Maybe the book will be a success. Maybe you can send your daughters to college with the book. God bless. He said, but if you do it on state time, then the state gets both of our royalties.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I don't think I can write on weekends. I hadn't perfected that technique yet, which I've done ever since, because
right.
I learned my lesson. I said, I better take, 4 weeks reluctantly, because we had a great time together every day, too. He said, okay. I took 4 weeks off. We did a really good book. You know, we talked almost every day because there were no fax machines. There was a state pouch that went back and forth in a day and a half. And, of course, it's the best-selling book I ever was involved with. produced the most royalties. And people say, that must have been very successful for you. I said, it was very successful for the next administration, because the Pataki administration got some of the money.
Wow.
But isn't that a mark of his
yes.
absolute integrity?
In this movie, the Egyptians are weak, cowardly, sniveling, vicious. As long as they were strong villains, I could overlook it. But they're weak, sniveling villains,
yeah.
And there's just no dramatic opposition, no dramatic clash in
All
this
right.
movie.
Regarding the plagues,
yeah. Oh, the plagues! Yes, I did enjoy the crocodile. jumping out of the river and devouring the fishermen. I did enjoy that.
I have to say, that's a plague I didn't remember from the story.
Yeah.
There's crocodiles.
I remember from the Bible story, frogs.
Frogs.
And
I remember frogs and locusts.
And locusts, yes.
I remember boils.
But hey, if you're in Egypt, why not crocodiles?
Of course, it goes without saying these days that that more and more people are no longer affiliating with traditional religious traditions. They're not in church on Sunday, by and large. And it's long been a kind of vocational question for me to ask, how can we serve them? And it's certainly a question Holy Family has asked for a long time. How can we help folks to encounter the Spirit here? If I were to put my Catholic bishop hat on, I would see that the concrete experience is that, ironically, Copper Beach is offering a new doorway for people to encounter the incredible Catholic life that's happening here.
You are listening to a Year in Review episode of Reasonably Catholic. Up next, excommunicated Mormon Kate Kelly, followed by gay Catholic Michael Reynolds, recalling his recent visit to the Vatican, and then Commonweal film critic Richard Oliva's 2015 Oscar picks. For the record, his choice, Boyhood, mostly got eclipsed by Birdman.
I kept participating. I always felt that there was something a little bit off with gender equality in the church, and my mom is a feminist and taught me that someday women would be ordained. Mm-hmm. She just never really said when.
Whether it would be in your lifetime, you mean?
Right. So eventually I got to the point where I felt very uncomfortable because I didn't feel like I could be my authentic self. I didn't feel like I could say what I really thought. I didn't feel like there was a space for dialogue about the sort of fundamental roots of gender inequality in the church, which is, in the Mormon church, all men, every single man above the age of 12, so men and boys, have the priesthood, and no women do. So it's not a case where there's a handful of people who commit themselves to the ministry. It's literally every single active man and boy. I went on my mission, and on your mission, you serve alongside primarily young Mormon men from the age of 19 and up. And they are put in a lot of leadership positions, but no girls are. And girls are allowed to do all of the grunt work. So we go out, we find people, we teach them, we kind of lead them to the point where they either, cut off the lessons or they want to get baptized. But we're not allowed to teach them, interview them, or baptize them. It's difficult to get in the mindset of a Mormon woman. It's so ingrained in you that this is the way that it is, that it's very difficult to break out of that and say, oh, maybe this isn't right. Maybe this isn't God's plan. Maybe this is unfair.
He left our area and went down below. And we heard screaming and cheers far from us.
Yeah.
But we stayed, and we just kind of took all of that in. And then he started making his way back up again. And there's a whole line of people in the back where we were, up by St. Peter's, that he greets, that was planned ahead of time.
Okay.
Including there was a newlywed couple, a husband and a wife, that were waiting for him there. And somebody from our group said to two of two people on our pilgrimage that were married, a couple, two women, you should be up there. You should go up there too. And so I just felt they didn't end up going back there, and I don't know if they even could have. It was a separate area.
Yeah.
But I felt, even hearing that comment, I thought, they're right.
Yeah.
They should be up there too, and kind of looking forward and thinking one day in our church that too will be a reality.
Wow.
Where there will be all kinds of couples there in line to meet the Pope, and that he will extend the same kind of love and greeting to them. And I had very quick feeling, strong feeling of that will come to pass.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
from your mouth to God's ears.
That was my prayer.
Do you want to tell us now, or do you want us to stay in suspense and save it for the end?
No, kill the suspense. I think Boyhood is going to get the main awards. And there's something unique about the way it was made over 10 years in the making, and watching a boy actually grow up, and watching Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette actually get 10 years older as they made the movie. There's something about it that garners attention, at least, if not a lot of money, and a lot of prestige, too. Also, the film that would normally make the grand sweep, which was Selma, which a movie with such noble subject matter and so well made and so well acted, has brought so much criticism on it for supposedly distorting the facts. I'm not so sure she really distorted facts that much. She bent a few things to make the movie more dramatic.
LBJ was kind of an obstacle.
Well, yeah, and I think there's a case to be made that if he wasn't an obstacle, at least he wanted to slow Martin Luther King Jr. down a bit and promote his own war on poverty program. I think there is some factual claim to that. Mm. Now, if she seems to make him, we're getting on the subject of Selma now.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's all right.
This is free form radio.
Yeah, stream of consciousness. I think that she simply bent the facts a little bit in order to show the heroism of Martin Luther King in pursuing his goal. And I think she's using LBJ not only for himself, but as a representative of all the liberal Democratic presidents preceding him, who sincerely wanted to do something for Black Americans. But for one reason or another, usually political reasons, usually in their dealings of Congress, wanted to slow things down and introduce measures that would gradually enfranchise the Black person.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and WHUS, 91.7 FM, Storrs, Yukon's radio for the people.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
The next interview is with Patty Vassia, a pillar of the Middletown community and an eclectically spiritual seeker. She's followed by a visit to the Wadsworth Athenaeum's Heaven and Earth exhibit with art historian Fran Altvater. And then there's a chat with Lincoln scholar Frank Williams, retired Rhode Island Supreme Court Justice, on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination. I saw you at holiday time, was it? Or before that?
Yeah, holiday time.
And you were drenched. Why don't you explain what I mean?
I got dunked. I got baptized by immersion at the Fellowship Church in Middletown. I had almost always wanted to be baptized by immersion. I felt that that's what I should do and wanted to do. But
for, like, your whole life?
I can remember being 10 or 11 and wanting to do that. My aunt was a Christian of the purest sense.
What does that mean? Is that a good or a bad thing?
That's a beautiful thing. You know, she wasn't very religious, but she held Bible study, and there was very evangelical Bible study in her home. And as a young person, I was often visiting her. My mom had died, and I was staying with her from time to time.
How does this add up to not being very religious? She's having Bible studies in her house.
Well, she didn't go to church.
Wow.
So I don't remember her going to church very often. And in those Bible studies, they were very good and deep understanding of the Bible and what Jesus says, his commission to baptize those, to evangelize. And I always felt that, you know, I believed in Jesus and I should do what he said. So I went to their baptism class before, you know, to explore what it meant, and met with the pastor, and yeah, I qualify. I believe. Yeah.
But you'd already been baptized.
As a child, I didn't have anything to do with that. My parents had to do with that. That wasn't my decision. And I felt, you know, it fits with the eclectic. When they say, what's your religion? I say eclectic, because I don't seem to fit in a mold.
What I find really interesting is, this is a piece called Icarus, the Lament for Icarus. It's not our traditional Judeo-Christian idea of heaven and earth. And in fact, it's really, you know, that collision of heaven and earth, right? It's that, yes. Icarus longs for heaven, longs for the glory of flight, and it is his pride that drives him to the ground. And so we see these tremendous wings, and these very beautiful nude ministering figures. They're not mermaids, but there's water and sea rock. So it's hard to know exactly who he intends them to be. But it's a good reminder that we could do what the Roman Christians did in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century and read back into those classical traditions.
Right, because Christians don't have a lock on heaven and angels.
Right, or a lock on those desires of the divine, the drive, and the way in which we come crashing to earth sometimes.
Right, sometimes daily.
In the end, as transparent as he was in his public life and as a lawyer and politician, he was a very private person, and he and almost enigmatic, holding cards very close to his vest. So you don't know what all he was thinking about or planning. And that's why the study of him remains so fascinating, even after 16,000 books and pamphlets have been published about him. But if you're asking about his mental state or acuity or lack thereof, he was what we would describe today a clinically depressed. And he called it melancholia at the time. They certainly didn't have the science we have today, or psychiatrist or psychologist that could help, or the medicine that do help people who suffer mental illness. Yet, the thing about him that's so great is that he was able to work through it. We know that it went back to his early years, which were, let's say, early 20s, 21 to 29 in New Salem. That's the village that he settled in after he left the family home in Decatur, Illinois. New Salem is about 30 miles northwest of Springfield. And that's where he, we think, fell in love with Ann Rutledge, who was engaged to another man who left for a long time. And they were very close. We don't know how close. And she died, we think, of typhoid. And he was absolutely beside himself with grief. And his neighbors, and it was a very close community, probably no more than 100, 125, really worried about his physical and mental health, that he might even hurt himself. And they provided companionship and maternal care, and let him live with some of the people that that resided in New Salem until he was able to overcome this grief.
This is Reasonably Catholic's Year in Review episode. Next, Future Church's Deb Rose Milovec on signs of progress when it comes to women's place in the Catholic Church. And a chat with Franciscan Father Sam Fuller, an environmentalist like his hero, St. Francis himself. And then a visit with the director and one of the stars of My Gay Son's Wedding.
I think this is a hopeful time. I really think that, I mean, as much as we like to talk about the church being a local church, and it is, and the people of God are the church, and they are, it does matter what happens at the top. It does matter in a church that's structured in the way ours is structured. And so one person, one man in this case, can have an awful lot of influence in our church, and he can use that to shut people down and to tighten up, the rules and make sure that everybody is walking in lockstep to the extent he can do that, or he can open things up and make it a mess. And I think that's what Francis is doing.
Well, he said he wants a big, messy church.
Yeah, he does. I mean, and that's exactly what he's doing. He's letting people be what people are really good at, which is coming together with all their diversity and all their love for the church and all the many ways that faith plays out in people's lives and, you know, with the things they trust and they distrust, and he's letting us talk. And for me, what happened in Rome with the Voices of Faith event, what happened in Limerick with the Priests and People event, and then what happened with the LCWR, these are all moments where this openness to the people of God is having a very positive impact, and in that way, this is a new era, and I want to do everything we can to take advantage of it, and then to help it to move forward into the future of the church as well. Because if this continues, I think we'll see a more healed, and more holistic church, and where people are feel more welcome and included and are able to shape the way the church works in a brand new way.
St. Francis really saw himself as blazing a new path outside the hierarchy of the church. He had great respect for the hierarchy of the church, but he really just wanted to start a community of what he called lesser brothers. But it captured the imagination of people and still captures the imagination, indeed, of our current Pope.
Whose name is Francis for that reason?
Very much so, sure.
That must have been a thrill to hear that he was going to call himself Francis.
Well, it's quite extraordinary. Of course, we know even more extraordinary for a Jesuit to maybe jump ship, in a sense.
and not call so, himself yeah, right. Pope Ignatius.
Yeah, well, of course, when we first knew the name, we just assumed he was naming himself after a Jesuit saint. There are several Francis Xavier, Francis de Sales, but to realize as Francis of Assisi was quite stunning and exhilarating. And of course, he has never ceased to continue to surprise.
Amen.
So he's been a wonderful example of, well, a Franciscan spirituality, of being grounded in God's love and God's mercy, and first and foremost in the pastoral care of all humanity.
Yes, Christ Church Cathedral. I had to check with them to see if this was the type of show that they would want in their space. And I didn't know anything about Episcopalians or anything, so I had to do research. So when I went online for their website and saw that they had an open policy for gays to come and worship it, I was like, oh, okay, this would be interesting. So,
did you produce the script to them?
Yeah, they wanted the script. They signed off on it, and I was shocked.
There were a few moments when I went, really? This is going to be in a church? It's kind of randy.
Oh, yeah. And they knew it. I was straight up at the front and told them what was going on.
Yeah.
And they go, okay, as long as, you know, it's not anything gratuitous or anything like that, so.
You know, underwear.
Yeah. I told them. That was one of the first things I said. There's a little language, and there's a little throwing of the underwear.
but not nudity.
No.
Don't misunderstand, no. Listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
discreetly.
I'm not for, I mean, it's not me for to write something that has nudity just to sell a script.
Right.
This one is so, you know, it's referred to.
Right.
But you don't see anything, so yeah. It's really good.
Next in our year-end roundup, Protestant Wesleyan student Lydia Ottaviano describing a faith-shadowing experiment intended to normalize religion on the Wesleyan campus. And Yale's humanist community hosts Following Jesus as a Secular Progressive, in which Tony Criz explains how post-Christian Portland, Oregon has shed its anxiety. And then syndicated cartoonist Rick Stromoski, creator of the Soup to Nuts strip, recalls his Catholic upbringing.
Speaking from my own experiences, I was able to appreciate the community that I have and that I'm a part of, seeing the other communities that I attended. So, for example, I went to the Catholic Student Organization meeting. And so by experiencing, just being at that meeting, it felt a lot like the meetings that West Christian Fellowship runs and that I normally attend, but then also some new ideas that you could even bring back and implement, because these groups aren't so different. And I guess in that example, in general, they really aren't so different, but even going to Shabbat services, having the community there and having the meal afterwards, and just bringing back different community events that you can really implement and bring these groups closer together. So seeing how each different group works makes it a lot easier to create events that sponsor interfaith dialogue and that would appeal to everyone. Just seeing the love and the kindness and the curiosity by all of the people in each group and the community that each event fosters.
Yeah, so some studies would say that Portland, Oregon is the first post-Christian city in North America. And that's saying something. And so there, we're experiencing some things that we've never experienced in the North American context, our unique sort of cultural context. And one of the things that I've been witnessing is as Christianity, or those who self-identify as Christians, as they've been moving from the majority to the minority, there's been this shocking sort of evaporation of anxiety out of the cultural system. Let me try and explain a little bit. In any system, in any social system, a majority group is going to release anxiety within that system. They're going to be perceived as a bully. We see this in a lot of contexts, be it political context or cultural context or whatever it might be, racial context. They're perceived, even if the people are very benevolent in what they're doing, there's this sense, there's a psychological energy that's released in the system that feels like anxiety to people. And it causes defensiveness. In Portland, we've seen sort of a release of anxiety, which has really been fascinating. For instance, the city government, which is not just a secular government, but it's full of particularly non-religious people, has really embraced local churches and has come alongside and asked local Christian churches to fully partner with the city government to solve the city's problems, including things like complete access to all public schools. There are public schools currently in Portland that have church offices on the grounds to supply clothing programs, food programs, mentoring programs, sports-related programs, particularly in the poorest neighborhoods. And churches are given pretty much full access under the understanding that this is not going to be a religious leveraging experience, but a service-providing experience. And today there are 250 partnerships between local churches and local schools in the city of Portland, something that in a lot of areas of the country is completely unheard of. Matter of fact, most people think we're crazy for doing it because of the separation of church and state. But this release of anxiety has allowed this to happen. Another great example is, at this point, currently the Department of Human Services has more or less turned over a large chunk of foster care to local churches to train, supply, care for local DHS offices, and supply of the vast majority of the foster parenthood and transitional programs are done not just by Christians, but literally from within churches. Churches are providing the office space and the space for a lot of these programs in order to be done on a more local level. It's unheard of.
So everything we had to learn by memorization, and one of the things is what you say when you go into the confessional for the first time.
Yes.
You have to say, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned."
Yeah.
This is my first confession.
Yes.
Well, I did that probably for the first 4 months of confession.
Because
whenever
you didn't
I went
think.
Into the confessional, I would say, "Bless me, Father, if I've sinned, this is my first confession." And Father Duffy finally said, "Are you sure? Is this your first confession?" I said, "Well, he said, did you confess last week?" And I said, "Well, yeah."
Oh.
"Well, this isn't your first one, is it?" He goes, "No." So I started thinking, well, I got to add them all up now. So after about, you know, another week or two went by, I said, "Bless me, Father, for I've sinned. This is my 14th confession." So he would say, "No, you don't have to do that. Just say, 'Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been a week since my confession.'"
Right.
Said, "Oh, okay."
Oh.
But then I had it mangled where you did penance.
Okay.
I mangled penance for the first few months, or actually maybe a month or two. One time I was doing my penance, Father Fire and Brimstone was sitting probably 20 feet from me, had no one in line, and was just watching me. So I went into the pew, knelt down and said, glory be, our Father, Hail Mary, got up and left. And Father Fire and Brimstone grabs me by the arm and says, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going home." And he said, "Well, what was your penance?" I said, glory be, our Father, Hail Mary. And he said, "No, you have to recite the entire prayer." And I'm thinking, oh my God, that's going to take a while. And now I've got all this, you know, retroactive praying I have to do, and there's a wiffle ball game I have to get to. So
I love it.
So I would put that in my comic strip.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and WHUS, 91.7 FM, Storrs, Yukon's radio for the people. The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management.
It's a medical breakthrough, a doctor's prescription to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't go to the pharmacy, you go to the supermarket for fruits, vegetables, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods. Side effects may include increased energy, healthy weight loss, and lower cholesterol. For a free recipe booklet, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project, committed to preventing cancer and improving survival.
You're listening to a Reasonably Catholic Year in Review episode. Up next, Commonweal film critic Richard Oliva compares Catholic writers Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene. And author Francis Cody weighs in on Waugh and Thomas Merton. And then, big news on the Connecticut death penalty front, courtesy of activist Sheila Degnan.
I think Evelyn Waugh saw Catholicism so different from his friend Graham Greene, of whom he disapproved but loved. Loved as a man, respected as a novelist, but disapproved of him as a Catholic. Of course, Evelyn Waugh probably disapproved of everybody else's Catholicism. Because...
what was it?
Evelyn Waugh regarded Catholicism as a adherence to a time... honored an old tradition. In other words, he was reverting to the mother faith. He would not be an Anglican or any other kind of Protestant because those were protests against right. the original Catholic faith. He wanted to be part of the original Catholic Church. So he was a reactionary in the truest sense. He was reacting to other people's rebellions. He wanted to be as traditionalist as possible. For Graham Greene, it was completely different. I think he became a Catholic out of a sense of rebellion because Catholics were in the minority and discriminated against in England until the late 19th century. So, I mean, Catholics could not hold political office. They could not vote until there was this act passed by Parliament in the middle or late 19th century. But they were discriminated against right up until almost 1900.
Do you have any knowledge of whether his faith was in fact faith, or was it all just nose thumbing?
Yeah, I think it was, number one, nose thumbing. Number two, a fascination for him because of the mysteries of the Catholic Church. Why does why does a good man supposedly go to hell if he commits a mortal sin at the last moment? Why does a person as evil as anybody, as Caligula, as Hitler, as anybody, why could he have a possibility of salvation if he repented at the last moment? God's laws aren't man's laws, and therefore he finds in this mystery a great source of fascination, especially in the Catholic Church. And he uses these theological conundrums to spice up his fiction. But I wouldn't want to suggest that he was insincere. I really think he tried desperately hard to believe. And I think he ended up feeling that he was in some sense still a Catholic, but a pretty bad Catholic. And he was willing...
A reasonable Catholic.
just a bad Catholic.
Waugh went to some pains to visit Merton in the monastery, and I get the feeling it's not entirely because he was a famous writer. It was because of some need in Waugh.
Well, yeah. On the other hand, I mean, Waugh and his Catholicism are also intriguing to me because, as I indicate in the book, he did go out of his way to go to the monastery in Kentucky. I mean, you go out of your way to get there, you have to go out of your way anyway.
Correct.
And yet he only stayed less than 24 hours.
Hmm.
And Waugh says in an article that he wrote subsequent to that, that he says that, irritatingly, he says, you know, a journalist grabbed him as he was getting on the boat, said, what did he like best in America? And his answer was the Gethsemane Monastery in Kentucky. So it's odd to know that if in fact that is what he did like best in America, that he stayed for such a short time and he never went back.
Yeah.
Even though he did visit the U.S. twice again.
Mm.
What he was attracted to, it's unclear to me whether it was the style of prayer of the monks, because there were Benedictine monks in England that he was very close to.
Mm.
It was called Downside Abbey, and he went there for Easter every year. He was very close to some of the monks there. So it's that's intriguing to me as well.
It feels to me like it was some wish that he could be more contemplative and some awareness of the deeper level of living that exists in a monastery, but also the discomfort with it because he never went back, as we said. So,
no, I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there was certainly, there was very definitely that pull.
Yeah.
That pull in Waugh. Temperamentally, he was so complex.
Congratulations.
Thank you again. I'm elated.
I want to give you this brief opportunity just to do a little victory lap. Tell us what happened and why it's important.
The Connecticut Supreme Court released a ruling that the state's death penalty has been unconstitutional. So that's the end of the death penalty in Connecticut. And it's important to me because I'm one of the people who, among thousands, who have worked for a long time to get to this goal. It's the fulfillment of the vision of Connecticut Network to abolish the death penalty. When we got prospective repeal in 2012, that was really only a significant step to what we wanted because we still had a death row. And today, or very soon, that death row will be empty and empty forever.
Up next, Reasonably Catholic's patron saint, Father John Baptist Pesch, enthuses over Pope Francis, and Patrick Cummins, director of bird conservation for the Connecticut Audubon Society, proves to be on the same page with the Pope when it comes to his encyclical on the environment. And then a moment with one of the thousands of pilgrims along Francis's three-city love fest in America.
Bergoglio made mistakes, but the gift that he had, he was able to profit from his mistakes. For example, for a long time, his concern with the poor was just, you might say, philanthropic concern. In other words, let's reduce their poverty. I mean, let's make... But he learned from Pedro Arrupe, and he learned from other Jesuits. He learned from other Jesuits who he listened to, see, that actually we have to change the structures. So that's when he gave himself to changing the structures. And he really gave himself to that. And also what he found himself doing was he was doing what 2 decades before that he had criticized some of his own priests for doing. He grew in his knowledge of what the gospel meant. See, and it was, he learned from the lay people. He learned from the lay people. The lay people were, he understood that the church is not only a teaching church, but the church is a learning church. And the church cannot be a good teaching church unless she's a learning church. So therefore, he started to learn from the people. And that's very, very important.
You know, a lot of it has to do with climate, which is a major issue. It's going to have human impacts as well as environmental impacts. And, you know, if we are the stewards of the earth and our actions are adversely affecting the planet and potentially adversely affecting the human population of the planet and potentially and almost certainly impacting the animals of the planet and their habitats, it's really our responsibility to do everything we can to address that.
Right.
A lot of it has to do with your interpretation or your translation of dominion, as it says in the Bible. And some people feel that it means that we are masters of the planet and the planet is ours for the taking. And some people even go as far to say is that being conservation-minded shows a lack of faith that God will provide, which is ironic because a lot of those same people are very conservation-minded when it comes to other resources, when it comes to money, you know, that you have to conserve money, but we don't need to conserve resources, you know. So it's kind of hypocritical a little bit. But, you know, and other people interpret that the meaning of the word dominion is that they're the stewards of the planet. It's their responsibility to make sure that it's there for future generations. You know, and some people even feel that, you know, we don't need to worry about future generations because the world's going to end anyway. So, you know, and some people, you know, kind of celebrate that, which to me, that's scary.
Wow. Get therapy. That's crazy.
Yes.
I'm from Arlington, Virginia, and we met in D.C. both as volunteers. As Maria mentioned, she works for the diocese, and I actually work for the federal government. And I've been helping any way I can, and I took 2 weeks off.
Is this a volunteer thing?
Yes. Yes, this is.
Bless your heart.
Yes, and so this is just breathing the same air.
Amen. That's how I feel. I'm not getting anywhere near the Pope, but still, it's so worth it.
Yeah, I was happy. And for the last year, after he announced that he was coming, I said, oh, I'm getting a hug. I am getting a hug. I don't know how. I don't know where. I might get kicked out. I might get arrested. But I'm going to do it. But really, it was kind of a joke. Okay? Because how the heck am I going to... How is this going to happen? So on this particular morning, I was assigned to cover at the Nunciature as a volunteer to do what I had to do, and
this is again in D.C.
Yes, again, yes. So the Nunciature, the ambassador's home to the U.S. in D.C., and that's where he was staying. And so this was very early. He had the speech at the White House that morning, and before he left, there was a gathering of probably, I don't know, 80 to 100 students from age 8 through high school, a mixture of public and Catholic schools. And I was stuck too, like, don't move. I was in lockdown. And once the cardinal came out, I thought, uh-oh. And they moved the fiat in front of us. And we're like, oh. And I said, kids. So I actually had a moment to cheer the kids on and kind of.
Because it was about them for you.
I was about them. They were there. I said, it's okay. Do you think he'll shake our hands? I'm like, if you ask, yes, he will. I said, if you want a hug, just ask him. And he touched everybody and gently, and we know he had to go meet with the president, but he
details.
But he shook anybody who got near him. He touched if they wanted to be touched. He did, and the kids were so amazing. I think, and so grateful. They actually opened a space for me. And miss, and I grabbed his hand, And like a grandfather, I couldn't help it. I mean, I lost my grandfather a long time ago, and I see him, and I see a grandfather. I grabbed his hand. I couldn't help it, and I kissed it. And not in that reverence like people used to kiss the Pope, but it was this tender moment. And in that moment, I asked him for a hug. I said, would you hug me? And I asked him in Spanish, which is also my native tongue. And I'm like, me da un abrazo. And he just gestured, of course, you know, and he gave me the warmest smile. I'm like, wow. And yeah, it's beyond me. I think today it hit me. This was 2 days ago. And I didn't even know it was plastered all over the news. People were texting me that they had seen me on TV. I'm like, what? And knowing that she got a selfie, now I can share that. I feel like, I don't know.
She was feeling guilty.
I was feeling guilty that I got a chance to hug the Pope. You know, who am I?
Like, you are a real Catholic.
Oh, yeah, I got the guilt down really, really well, you know, from birth to over 40 years of practice. Uh-huh, yes.
If you're just joining us, this is Reasonably Catholic's Year in Review episode. Up next, Joy and the Good Life at Yale. And a recap of what happened during the Synod on the Family in Rome, with Holy Cross Professor Matt Schmalz, followed by the ever-optimistic Future Church Director, Deb Rose Milovec. Welcome back. We are here with Matt Crosman and Tom Krautenmaker of Yale in various capacities. And there's some news out of Yale. I got a press release announcing this pretty cool deal, a $4.2 million grant to study the theology of joy and the good life. I mean, I am so all about joy right now because I'm just coming off the Pope's visit, which, as many issues I have with the Pope, nonetheless, there was such a just pervasive sense of joy everywhere you went in the crowd that I would say even reverberates yet. Plus, I attended a Stevie Wonder concert. He is amazing. He embodies joy. He really, really was having a great time, and I think it was contagious throughout the arena. I don't know. I'm having a good run of joy lately, although now that I see it's the subject of study at Yale, I'm concerned that maybe I'm not really having joy, but some other thing. Maybe we should start by defining the term, and then maybe then we'll go back and discuss what the genesis of this whole shebang was. Does that sound cool?
Yeah, Matt can do that for you, but please, Matt, when you do so, don't destroy Maria's joy.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
We certainly have no interest in becoming the joy police. That is the last.
Okay. I worry that it's like, you know, looking at an eclipse, you know? You shouldn't look at joy too closely or you're just going to harm.
Blind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it definitely does feel like something that you wouldn't want to kill by analyzing it, right? And you wouldn't want to. It may be that sort of thing, right? That in the middle of experiencing joy, instead switching to thinking about your experience of joy,
right,
may suddenly cause it to disappear, right?
Right.
That may be true.
I think what is interesting in some ways to connect all of this back to Pope Francis is how the constellation of issues that Catholics are associated with is beginning to change. I mean, I think, at least in the public's mind, being a Catholic was associated with being a cultural warrior around issues regarding abortion or contraception or
pelvic zone.
Yeah, pelvic zone type of issues, and that's changing. I mean, that really is changing, particularly with Pope Francis coming out very strongly against the death penalty.
Yeah.
Being a pro-life Catholic means something a bit different now than it did even a year ago.
It really is enough to make you think the Holy Spirit paid a visit to Rome.
Despite it all, I think the Holy Spirit is there, and certainly the Holy Spirit does reside in the hearts of anybody who's even half open, and there were a lot of people at least half open, if not more, and so there's a lot of good things going on, and you just have to look to see it,
and live long enough.
Yeah, no, I mean, once again, none of this is fast enough. I mean, you know, good gravy. If we're content with this, we're out of our minds. But the bottom line is, things are moving, and in the world of diplomacy, and in the world of large institutions, you know, institutional change, organizational change is not easy, and that's what Pope Francis is trying to do. He's trying to lead this organization through change, and it is not easy, and he's getting lots of pushback.
We have to.
But it's not very nice.
You know, really. Play nice now.
That's right. They don't do that. They don't do that.
Well, we'll have to pray for him as he's asked us to.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, good gravy, Deb Rose Milovec. It's been wonderful once again. I'm just so glad to know you, and I just want you to keep on keeping on. Stay healthy. And,
yeah. Thanks a bunch. Yeah,
awesome.
We will. We're going to keep on keeping on. We have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of Catholics who care about it, and so we're working together to bring this church forward.
We'll end our year in review as we ended the year with a look at the film Spotlight, plus an introduction to Wesleyan's new Catholic chaplain, Father Bill Walker.
I want you to bring to mind as much of the movie's unfolding as you can and tell me what you really reacted to emotionally when you saw it.
Truth be told, I cried when the word Spotlight appeared on the screen at the very beginning.
Oh.
And I was smart enough to bring two handkerchiefs, and I cried throughout the whole film. I know all of these reporters, and I know all but one of the victims who were portrayed in the film, and they just did an amazing job. It's very, very accurate, and it manages to be incredibly suspenseful, even though we all know the outcome.
Yes. That's why I don't worry about giving anything away. We all know.
Right, how it turned out.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I guess struck me the most about the film. I also worried about it giving a sort of an oversimplification.
Mm.
And like, you know, here are the good guys, here are the bad guys. But the film very wisely and again accurately points out that a number of individuals and institutions had knowledge and suspicions about the abuse and cover-up and either actively hid it,
mm-hmm.
As in church officials, or sort of passively ignored it.
Yeah.
So even people, I worry about giving away too much, but even people who you think initially in the film are heroes,
right.
You know, towards the end you have to kind of pause and realize, well, you know, they too missed some signs.
Right.
So I'm really, really hoping that this film is going to give some courage to journalists and police and prosecutors and church whistleblowers. I mean, I'm convinced that there absolutely are thousands of people out there with knowledge or suspicions about clergy sex crimes and cover-ups who still haven't, you know, spoken up.
Right.
And need to.
I tell people that when I was growing up in the Bronx, I wanted to do three things. I wanted to be a priest, in large part because I always felt that this is what God was calling me to do. Secondly, I wanted to be an attorney because, in large part, my dad had a very big influence on me. From time to time, he would take me to court with him. We talk about cases. He did not make a lot of money, but he worked very, very hard and was always out there extending himself for people who really needed his legal counsel and advice. And then the third thing that I wanted to do growing up in the Bronx was to be the center fielder for the New York Yankees.
Well, two out of three ain't bad.
Two out of three is not bad at all. And it's been a very happy and rewarding career thus far.
And that's all for this episode of Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. Again, my heartfelt thanks to all of our guests and to you for listening. I wish you a happy, healthy, spiritually nourishing 2016. I'm Maria Johnson. See you next week on January 5th with a chat with Lisa Mladenich, author of a book on how women can find grace in the second half of life, plus a film review of the movie Brooklyn. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Acoustic Blender with Bill Revel.